Welcome back to Pax Europiana, the podcast about peace in Europe. And now it's about the EU days, and that's the 31st of December, which I want to discuss now. That's the day when the United Kingdom left the European Union, now just last year in 2020. And it's a mixed day. It's a complicated day. It's of course a very sad day because first time ever the European Union has lost a member. And that's of course a very big setback. That's will have major consequences, mostly negative one. And I will describe them in this podcast. But it's also a moment of departure, should be also a moment of reflection. Because the United Kingdom was since 1973 member of the EU and its predecessor organization, and it has been a very good time. So it's not, we should avoid any kind of acrimony and negativism about this period. It was a good time. We won the Cold War together. And this is really what matters most. Huh? Together, of course, with the membership in NATO before already, but it was very decisive, the membership of the United Kingdom, of Ireland, of Denmark, when they came in 73. This was really a turning point. Still the 70s stayed so complicated, but it led this kind of amazing revitalization of the West in the 80s. Western Europe economic dynamism was very much depending on the UK also reviving economically, and that was only possible in the stable framework and in the market opportunities of a reformed European Union, where as well the United Kingdom did so much to reform the European Union. There was much less sclerotic and kind of statist kind of trade in the agriculture and industry, with the UK inside and bringing all this entrepreneurial and free market spirit in the European Union. So together we were really very successful. We contained the Soviets, we outperformed them, and it was really very successful. And the UK has turned out to be again as rich and as dynamic and powerful economy as it was before the First World War. Obviously a bit different in the situation, but when you see also the pride and the success, which is now so dominant, it was not like this in the 50s. It was not like this in the 60s. Yeah? It was not in the 70s. Yeah? This came only then with membership. And so we should look back, not in anger, but look back to our common kind of marriage in success, and really also see it exactly like I have outlined it, as a successful partnership for this. It was now 47 years altogether. And it was a half a century united in economic and political terms, and that was very good. Obviously, it was never an easy marriage. It was always full of complication, because the UK always in this tradition of the double World War winning superpower, obviously no longer having this kind of economic relevance, was very painful for the United Kingdom. When the big powers of the Soviet Union and the United States were basically dividing the world, and the United Kingdom was no longer so relevant in the post-World War situation. That was, of course, very complicated for the United Kingdom, and it never easily fitted, you know, to consult with all these other Europeans. It was more used to tell everybody else what to do than to always listen to others and also let the Austrians talk. That's, of course, very painful. So that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is I would like to say very much that it is so that I was very much against Brexit, and I hate Brexit, and I was fighting Brexit, and I think it was completely wrong. And also, let's be very honest, the only reason why this referendum, this lousy referendum, was getting a majority, but there were several reasons, huh? But it's very much connected to the Russian Cold War we have, because Russia was not just financially intervening very heavily, with internet trolls intervening very heavily, intervening very heavily with this massive Russian accumulated wealth that's already stored in the United Kingdom since the end of the Soviet Union, and all the powerful kind of oligarchs which they have based in the United Kingdom, and they also acquired a lot of political influence. But it's also very much connected, obviously, to the migration crisis of 2015. And let's not forget where these people came from, mostly from Syria. And that's a result of this Syrian civil war, where Russia was the bad actor, supporting Assad. There would never have been a migration crisis without Russian political, economic, and military intervention in Syria. Let's be very honest and clear on that one. And also, there is also another aspect which is important, also the Trump election, because it was also in the year when Trump was already so much empowered, again with a strong Russian link, and Trump being so clearly against Brexit was of course damaging for the Remainers, there's no doubt. And also pretty lousy Cameroon, that's probably possible the only factor where Russia didn't have a lot to say that Cameroon was such a lousy prime minister. Anyhow, that's my personal opinion. So one thing which also the Brexit was about was obviously the relation with the United States and the failure of TTIP. This we can also not blame on the Russians. We can only blame this on Obama's general kind of inconclusiveness and lack of leadership in everything that was really a lot of work and what not could not be done with some speeches and handshakes, and also with German anti-Americanism from the German left. Obviously, it was Mr. Gabriel very much who was killing TTIP, but the French obviously were very happy to kill it as well. So there was our big failure in TTIP. And obviously that played a big role, because it's not just geography and history and personal connection, but the United Kingdom is really in between the US and the EU. Would we have done TTIP? I think the whole economic case for Brexit would have been disappeared, because then a big roof between the US and the EU and the UK would have been built. And still, it's one of the ways to really make sure that the effect, the negative effects of Brexit are really much less if we manage to achieve a free trade deal with the United States of America from the side of the EU and obviously also the UK. So these are, I think, the main reasons, and also this kind of post-imperial complex which the UK always had, the UK elite, and the higher up it goes, they never they could really accustom to this kind of European submission in their view, that somebody is above them in a way, that they have to coordinate their policy with somebody else, like, for example, their partners. That was very much beyond them, and they're below their standards in their view. And I've met many of the British Eurosceptics in my life, and it was always the same, you know. The moment they say some nice things, but when you then start to speak with a German accent, then it's about the moment they think that we are back and not the good guys. And so this is a lot of things deep in the subconscious has to do with World War II, and also with the principal idea that coordinating policy was never the idea of the United Kingdom. With all respect, it's more them telling us what to do and politely for some seconds listening if there's any kind of reply, but not so politely then reacting if you say still something is not so much okay. So I had my experiences with my friends in the European Parliament, with all respect and dear appreciation. But there is obviously this kind of post-imperial inferiority complex, yeah, which is then hypercompensated when you are additionally very rich already, because you are then also very successful, or you have inherited a lordship. It is all pretty much annoying to discuss with the Lithuanians and take them seriously, because that's what we are in the European Union. You have to take every country seriously, every member in the parliament seriously. Everybody has a vote, and you have to find the consensus. And that was not exactly the way the British wanted to do business in Europe. Anyhow, so far, so good. So after this, I would like to discuss a bit what is the future relation, because now we have the trade agreement. Luckily, in the last moment, that was possible, and that's very good. Obviously, we do have to also make sure that we have a special relationship with the United Kingdom. Also to find, as I have said already so often, United Kingdom, please to join the Central European Free Trade Agreement to be connected with the Eastern European partners. Also make sure Turkey and Ukraine and Georgia and Azerbaijan join that. So we have at least some structural cooperation where the UK has a significant role in the European trading system. That I think would be good, without any kind of difficult limitations on the UK sovereignty, because I understand that is in the current climate unacceptable for the UK. So that would be one thing. And the other thing is also that the whole question, and here I would like to discuss about the UK internally, because that's a big topic for me since 30 years already. I was advocating for a more federal United Kingdom. And here we have now the Scottish regional election coming up in May 2021. And also the question is now, what will be the situation in the coming years with Scotland? Because there's a big driver behind now the Scottish independence. And some people in Europe think that's a really good idea somehow to integrate then Scotland as a new member state in the European Union, and also diminish the independence and the strength of the United Kingdom. And I'm absolutely against Scottish independence. Yeah. Let's be very sure. Then let's be totally clear. That's not a good idea. It was never a good idea in 2014. And also today, the way the Scottish nationalists want to do that, leaving possible NATO as well, and somehow making a very disruptive kind of, I call it a Russian Scottish exit. I'm totally against that form of exit. Yeah, it should never happen. I'm also, you know, very skeptical about every other form of Scottish exit and independence, because why? It doesn't really have any kind of human rights problems in Scotland. I'm against so-called luxury independence projects. That means in countries where there is complete fine the human rights of the people, just for some kind of esoteric reasons to look for independence. I'm against Catalonians and Scottish. If there is a problem with human rights, for example, let's say they have a very strict kind of protection of the king in Spain, seemingly, I don't know the details, then we have to fix that one in the framework of the Council of Europe, in the framework of Spain, in this framework of a working democracy inside a federal system, inside the European Union, and not somehow in a way of leaving and separatism and secessionism. Because there's always huge costs in secession and separatism. There's always people who are against it, and their rights have to be taken into account as well. So that's important. I'm for independence of Montenegro, of Kosovo, of many countries in the world. I've supported the independence, and I'm very much in favor. If, for example, there's a dictatorship, when cities are bombed, like in Chechnya, I think in that case, it's very clear that central government has lost the legitimate control of that region once it kills its own citizens, or it makes human rights a joke. So I'm very much against the concept of luxury independence of Catalonia and Scotland. Additionally, never forget, the Scottish independence will also lead to a major crisis in Northern Ireland, because what will be then the consequence? Yeah? Will there be unification? I'm totally against that. Yeah? So it's not a good idea to have the Scottish leaving, and then the Northern Irish will be, some people anyhow want unification. So we have the next Irish crisis. What about Wales? What about Gibraltar? We have the next Spanish Gibraltar crisis, and so on. So the Scottish do their egocentric kind of luxury independence, and we are then stuck with all these regional conflicts in the NATO and the European Union. I say no, 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 no. So as I have said many times on Twitter, there is one way to do it. And that's the only way I would recommend also for the European Union to endorse. That means if the Scottish can really build a coalition with the Northern Irish and with the Wales people, from the Welsh people, from Wales, and also with the Gibraltar residents and the authorities there, and also with the Isle of Man, and also maybe with some other of the island regions, which are part of the United Kingdom to these days, could be also these Channel Islands and others, and they form a new federation. Like, for example, a Dominion, it was called in the case of Australia and Canada, which are both federal states. Yeah. They have basically gradually shifted out of the United Kingdom in the end of the 19th century until basically the First World War was also a big turning point. And they have basically kept some common institutions like the Supreme Court, like the Queen, obviously. They have kept it for very long. And gradually only Australia has developed in her own statehood and Canada as well. And this is role models that I could envisage. As a new federation, I call it United Britain, and that would be an option. If Wales is ready, Northern Ireland, and this is a working concept, it's about 10 million people, this could also then stay in NATO, stay with the under the crown, so there would be no constitutional or security or alliance change, and then obviously also that is a condition to have the euro, and also then to be basically moving into the European Union rather fast. That I could imagine as a scenario, which I think Australian-style separation with the consent of London, and also then these five regions as a federation, let's call it under the name of United Britain, it would be the more British, the more Celtic regions united, that would avoid a lot of troubles, and that could make sense. But, okay, you know, it's not my preferred project. My preferred recommendation for the United Kingdom is to be the United States of the United Great Britain. Let's call it like this, the United States, a more US-style federation, a more US constitutional system. Of course, don't worry, you can keep the queen or the king in the future, no problem. But there is very systematic problems in the United Kingdom. It's called asymmetrical decentralization and devolution, you call it in the United Kingdom. And that's a major problem because the English regions, where most of the people live, it's 10 million people in the other regions, in the other five regions, and it's about 56 million people in England itself. But there is also regions like Cornwall, let's say, the Southwest, Yorkshire, and East Anglia, London, and these are nine regions, which today are regions in the United Kingdom, in the England, the regions of England, I talk. But, you know, the regional differences are huge. When you see the Eurostat data, until recently Eurostat has also measured the data of the United Kingdom in regional prosperity, it was about in the north of England just at 70% of the EU average, while London is at 600% of the EU average in GDP per capita in purchasing power per variety. So you see the difference is huge in prosperity. There's no other country which has so much regional inequality. Regional, that one region you are very rich when you live there, and then the other you are very poor. This kind of concentration of wealth in the southwest around London is totally unhealthy. And it is because you have a very centralized England. And that must change. So the normal system would be a US constitutional style, which the US brought to Germany and Austria and other countries after World War II, with British lawyers maybe helping them. But the idea is basically to have not five regions or four nations of the United Kingdom as you have it. That's totally wrong. Because also in England, the Yorkshire people are quite different than the Cornwallish or whatever it's called. Yeah? And so it's necessary to have probably of the five regions, which are a little bit more different from Gibraltar, Isle of Man, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, but also the nine regions of England. So it's 14. 14 federal states of the United States of the United Kingdom. Maybe you find the United States of Britain or whatever kind of title the country could have then. But such a transformation is really very important for more regional equality and for more equality in the country itself. Because, and don't be afraid, I'm not calling for a republic, whereas I love republics much more than monarchies. From the Austrian perspective, believe me, it's, I think, much better system. And also, ideologically, when you think about it, republics are quite good, actually, in terms of equality and reason and are modern forms. But okay, you have this monarchy, fine. But it's not so fine to have a House of Lords with inherited kind of peerage. Yeah? And that's not fine, because nobility can be inherited and they can have their estates and their land rights. You know, that's also questionable in some aspects. But good, this is the British system. We cannot change everything at once. But what is wrong is to give inherited political rights to a certain political group. That's wrong. That's absolutely wrong. And you know it. I think everybody understands that. So you have the House of Commons as the lower house. So the upper house obviously must be a US state kind of Senate. Or we have in Germany the Bundesrat, which is the secondary chamber. It's not so powerful. In Austria, even less powerful, the so-called Bundesrat as well, we call it like this. But what the US has achieved is kind of a bicameral system where both chambers have a reconciliation process, similar like we do it in the European Union as well, between the EU Council and the European Parliament. And that's a really very good system. So the logic would be that the 14 regions of the United States of the United Kingdom, that means the 9 English regions and the 5 regions from Gibraltar to Isle of Man, Scotland, have equal rights, each of them 2 senators. Or you do it like the European Union and you weigh it by the population. That's different. That's for a constitutional reform. But this second chamber should replace the House of Lords. They can all keep their titles, they can all keep their heritated kind of lordships and all this, but not to sit in any kind of political chamber. If you want them to be in a chamber once a year, you can invite them to a nice conference hall and call it the House of Lords. But that's fine if the Queen thinks that's fine to invite all the lords once a year, and you can give them also honorary title. But please, no Russian oligarchs and their children, if it's possible. Anyhow, that's another story. But the thing is that the second chamber should be a US state kind of Senate. And then you have maybe 2 senators from the 14 regions, or maybe you have ultimately 16 regions. Maybe you find the necessities for the Hebrides or for East London to have a separate kind of statehood inside this Federation of the United States of the United Kingdom, or you find a more interesting title, you just keep it United Kingdom, but you change the power distribution and you make sure that all the regions really feel part of the system, because that's the beauty of the US situation. Besides some lunatics, there's nobody who wants to run away with Alaska or with California, because they know the US is so successful, so powerful, and even the smallest state has 2 senators and is really powerful in the United States of America. We in the European Union, actually, we don't empower smaller nations as strong as the United States empowers Alaska or Minnesota or Wyoming or North Dakota compared to California. We have made this weighted voting system for the Germans and the French, Italians and the British in the past to have especially strong vote. But we also empower our regions. They all have their veto right, for example. So there's a lot of good things to be said for such a solution. And I think especially when you're now afraid of a high popularity of Scottish independence, that's the way, basically. It might sound a bit revolutionary, but it's not so much. It's, I think everybody should be consenting that the House of Lords needs to be changed, that the Northern English regions are really underrepresented and underinvested and completely poor, and that Scotland is not taking very seriously in the context of the United Kingdom, and nor is Northern Ireland or Wales or Gibraltar. And once everybody has a seat in the UK Senate, I would call it like this, I think everybody would be much nicer to them, and many of the infrastructure projects and the distribution of the taxpayers' money and this kind of really very disturbing centralism would be much more smoother. Obviously, it's not the same United Kingdom. You will not rule the waves and not maybe dominate world politics with such a system, because you always have to ask also all the regions. But as I would like to remind you, the United States has such a system, and they actually, it works quite well. To my best knowledge, it's the most successful democracy in the world and by far the only remaining superpower in this globe. And why not, if you actually had a Brexit because of a lack of closeness to the United States, why not a little bit orient and reform the United Kingdom similar to the United States of America? Because if you like it so much, why not take some of the role model? You don't have to go for the full republic, yeah? No worries. You can keep all your queens and lords and all your barons, yeah? But at least, you know, not to empower them politically with kind of a normative role in a legislator. I think that's really very wrong. You can, as I said, invite them for Christmas once a year to some Windsor Castle for some reception, and that's about it, yeah? They have also not done such great legislative performance since the Irish question, I remember, Home Rule, nor in any other of the great legislative debates from the Corn Laws to now. I don't see where the House of Lords has made a major contribution to British democracy. So we can do without it, I think. You can do without it for sure. So the situation of such a Senate, you can also call it Senate, so everybody understands what it is, yeah? And I think the Scottish nationalists would be surprised by such a proposal. The people in the north will maybe be surprised by so much empowerment when the first time the poor suppressed people of East Anglia and Yorkshire, normally only meant for being good soldiers and industrial workers, and they would be suddenly very much empowered to be also taken seriously. And some of these poverty-ridden regions in the middle of England would be, in the Midlands, you call it, would be basically suddenly receive a lot of investment. Yeah. So I think it would be quite a good idea, and it's much better than to break up with some kind of Russian-backed, you know, this kind of dubious Scottish nationalist leader, Elmond, or what his name is, who is working for Russian TV, and all this kind of Russian joy about the breakup of the United Kingdom, its big Cold War enemy, the country of Churchill, now already out of the EU, and then the next step would be to take away Scotland and the famous nuclear bases and the famous navy bases and all the complexion of that. So I think the only one who would really profit from a Scottish exit would be Russia, and so I'm fully opposed. But what everybody in the world would benefit a lot would be a more federal United Kingdom. And most of all, the English people would benefit. The poorer English people in the north and in the west, they would really very much benefit. But also the people in Wales and Scotland, because it's much better to be in a bigger country, in a strong and working economy, without any additional complexities and problems, but the United Kingdom really working much more smoother as with more devolution, with more kind of democracy, with less of this ancient kind of a bit dusty, rusty stuff from the House of Lords, and a little bit less of this kind of structural inequality regionally and also in its elite to its people. That would be quite a good and powerful vision for a modern United Kingdom in the 21st century. And this would also convince a lot of Scottish nationalist voters or Scottish middle-class voters or in Wales not to vote for any kind of secessionist dreams of a few. But they would say, ah, they have listened in London. Boris understands us. And then suddenly they would maybe endorse such a kind of a new, successful, modern, more American, more egalitarian, but also much more free and better governed United Kingdom. Let's call it the United States of the United Kingdom. And I think you get this idea, and this is what I think could also be one of the interesting results of a Brexit, because it now it's reality. Let's try to guide it into decency from its evil start into decency. And this is one of the good things that could happen. If it's good governed and good directed, Brexit could lead to such a more decentralized, more federal, more American Britain. That would be good. And I made one podcast already. It could also result in TTIP. free trade agreement between the UK and the US and piggybacking the EU attached to it. And that would be also a wonderful result. And they will stop laughing in Moscow about Brexit once we have achieved these two amazing outcomes out of this very sad reality of Brexit. So it's a double message with this 31st of December. It's of course a very sad day that the UK has left, but let's get over it. Let's form the future successfully and make sure that we somehow build a much better future for the Europeans, for the British, and for the Americans, for the Western people in this kind of new arrangement. And let's not fight each other, but let's work much closer together. Let's get TTIP done, and let's also try to have a much more federal, much better governed, much more equality-based, and much more American, much more successful United Kingdom. Would be good. Think about the 31st of December, and thanks for listening. And good luck, Britannia, on your way forward. Thanks for 47 good years. And now, bye.